This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll learn about how the San Luis Obispo County Regional Airport is adjusting to changes caused by the coronavirus.
The necessity of transportation in this emergency, you know, I would say goes along with many other types of services for grocery stores, gas stations, medical facilities. We ultimately still need to function on some level as a country and as an economy, and air travel is an important piece of that.
Also, we'll hear a conversation with Cal Poly journalism teacher Kim Bishop about sorting the facts from fiction in today's media.
As consumers, we never really remember who got the story first, but we always remember who got it wrong.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 23rd, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Here at KCBX, we hope you're staying healthy and feeling well. As the pandemic continues, we're going to keep bringing you a mix of timely Central Coast stories and interviews with interesting local people. We hope our listeners find the hour to be entertaining, thoughtful, and help provide good companionship if you're sheltering at home. Every day brings an increase to the number of COVID-19 cases on the Central Coast, and all restaurants and bars are closed, a devastating blow to the region's economy. In Monterey County, the hospitality industry on the Monterey Peninsula alone typically employs more than 23,000 workers. As KAZU's Doug McKnight reports, these are not normal times, and restaurants and workers are now struggling to find a new normal.
If you call a Monterey County restaurant these days, you make it a voicemail. Alyssa and her husband, Anthony Carnazzo, are owners of The Stationery, a neighborhood restaurant and coffee shop tucked away in a small courtyard in Carmel by the sea. An herb garden sits out front. The couple and their children live upstairs. Tuesday's shelter-in-place order by Monterey County's Public Health Department changed their business and their lives in an instant. Anthony Carnazzo says under the order, restaurants can no longer offer table service.
We used to be a sit-down restaurant that did a little bit of to-go. Now we have zero sit-down. Now we're a to-go restaurant. And what does that look like?
It means rethinking everything from marketing to menu. Food now has to be able to travel.
If it needs to go down a bumpy road and travel for 15 minutes, it's still going to be good at the other end.
So lose the delicate stuff. Then there's the whole business side, taking orders, collecting payments, arranging pickups. All in the new world of social distancing. And in order to survive, those changes have to be made immediately.
So it is happening, not just changing day by day, but changing, you know, hour by hour. And we're doing our best to try and basically create a new business overnight.
Carnazzo says the hardest decision he had to make was to let his nearly 20-person staff go. TJ Ellis was the restaurant's barista. For him, everything changed Tuesday morning.
And about 5 a.m., I read the email saying that we were going to be closed, and it was, extremely upsetting.
Because for TJ, the restaurant was more than just a paycheck.
The Stationery was honestly like my happiness, like my home. And being there and serving people was what kept me content.
He says he's still trying to figure out his next step. But Stationery is not the only business affected by the virus.
You know, all the retail stores, restaurants, everything like that is kind of just done.
He says his younger brother just arrived from Baltimore in hopes of finding work on the peninsula. Now with two in the house, Ellis is trying to think creatively about how to make ends meet.
We were trying to think of little things to do for our landlord that would help deduct rent.
If that doesn't work, he says he and his brother may have to move home to Baltimore. Back at Stationery, Anthony Carnazzo sits in the office of his now empty restaurant.
It's painfully quiet. The only noise to come from me right now is kind of the hum of the refrigerators.
He says he misses the sound of his customers and his employees. And then he recalls how his staff helped him close down the restaurant on the last day.
And my team, as always, did a beautiful job of cleaning up the restaurant. So everything is perfectly placed. All the tables are as they should be. All the silverware is polished. All the glasses are polished on the shelves. It's a restaurant ready to go, ready to feed people, but it's going to be a while before we're able to do that again.
Sadly, for restaurants and workers all over California, this may be the week that changes their world forever.
That was KAZU's Doug McKnight reporting from Monterey County. Next, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer talks with Kevin Booman, director of the San Luis Obispo County Regional Airport. Booman offers insights into the current status of air travel and specific health and safety responses at the airport to COVID-19. The interview took place last Thursday, March 19th.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from San Luis Obispo County Airport, and we're here with Kevin Booman, airport director. Hi, Kevin. Status right now for air travel and San Luis Obispo County Airport.
So the airport's open and the airlines are flying. The national air transportation system is open. The constant changing status of various government directives from the federal, state, and local government, really at any level, is either exempted airports explicitly or there's been no mandate to change any of our operations. That being said, the airlines are certainly reacting as private businesses in ways you would expect with either actual changes or forecasted changes to their operations.
But nobody knows. I mean, there's scuttlebutt that there could be a domestic air travel shutdown, right? That's a possibility.
That's been mentioned at different times in the last few days, but you know, as of this morning on a national call I was on, that's still seeming unlikely, but you know, we say that one day and then 2 days later things seem to happen. I'm not going to say it won't ever happen, but it still seems unlikely. The necessity of transportation in this emergency, you know, I would say goes along with many other types of services for grocery stores, gas stations, medical facilities. We ultimately still need to function on some level as a country and as an economy, and air travel is an important piece of that.
So on one level, it is an essential service.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we're staffing accordingly. We've got contingency plans in place to the extent we can sustain the operation in various evolutions of this as perhaps staff become ill or other types of things start to occur. Challenging here because we're such a small facility, we don't have a lot of bench strength, as you can imagine.
The airport is almost empty. Looking at the board, you have a couple outbounds getting ready to go this afternoon.
Correct.
You have Seattle. Yeah.
We had a few cancellations today, primarily weather-related, and then Las Vegas was having an air traffic control issue as well earlier with the tower. So, you know, the normal course of operations still occurred. We don't have service to Salt Lake City, but the airport there was closed yesterday for several hours due to an earthquake. Yeah. So, you know, other things still happen.
Let's talk about protocol at the airport itself. Health and safety and wiping down.
Last week increased our custodial wipe down efforts for contact surfaces and put into place measures to assure that was happening in key places many times a day.
And how about access for the traveler when I come in? Is there a sanitizer?
There is, although that's not something we've had in the facility in the past, and it took us several days to get that in place. We have limited amounts of that now, and like anywhere, it's difficult to obtain that type of product. So as those become more available, we'll continue to deploy them. But we've had challenges there like a lot of other entities have.
A little bit more about your life, your world today. The primary challenges and issues that you have.
I think the fundamental challenge we have is that the federal government emphasized on Monday the guidance that airports are to remain open. You know, that was coming directly from senior management at the FAA. Whether it's local or state authorities cannot selectively choose to close or restrict their airports.
It's a federal mandate.
It's a federal mandate. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge that immediately creates is when you look at the essential functions both we as the airport team have to fulfill, as well as all our partners from public safety, air traffic control, Transportation Security Administration, all the other pieces of making this operation work. At our facility, we're all small teams, and it doesn't take a lot to imagine that small team could become unable to perform that function. So to the extent we've worked through scenarios that we can sustain it, we will do so.
So primary challenge for you is keeping your employees healthy.
Yeah, we've closed our administrative office and deployed that team to all work remotely. We started dispersing that team on Monday, and as of today, they'll all be working remotely. The operations and maintenance teams remain on site. There's plenty to do. Despite the lower traffic volumes, we're keeping busy with several new tasks, as well as even catching up on some things from time to time that we can't do.
An example.
Some certain maintenance functions that we might have to do during off hours when there's fewer people
in an area. To the physical plant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we are trying to position ourselves to even perhaps take advantage of this in some ways too.
So some opportunities.
I'd like to say so, if there is such a thing at this point.
Let's talk back to the aircraft outbound today. What are the loads like?
So we don't get real-time load data from the airlines, but looking at our parking and our passenger checkpoint numbers, you know, I'd say we're running, as of today, probably below 30% on any flight. Just a couple days ago, we were closer to 50%, with Cal Poly announcing the changes that they have. The last several days have seen a lot of student traffic.
So you're going to have more students going home.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think as that wraps up here this week, you know, certainly there's very little inbound.
So inbound traffic, real light.
Real light. This week has definitely seen a shift to folks flying out of the market. You know, I expect that's going to be what we see for some time to come. Mm-hmm. You know, the hardest part in this event is looking at the timeline. You know, we can say with some certainty that measures that have been put in place have a given duration to them, but are those going to be evaluated and extended? You know, many events that airports plan for as part of our emergency planning are more typically they're short duration, high intensity event. You know, started as a creep and then has ramped up rather quickly, but now the duration and intensity, duration unknown and intensity getting more and more significant. So how long this goes and to what extent, the question everyone's asking, but the airports in particular, because even once we move into recovery, what does demand look like when it finally comes back and how quickly does it come back? Mm-hmm.
This isn't your department or bailiwick, but you have any sense of the cost of flying on aircraft? Have the rates come down?
I looked at that briefly a few days ago, and it's kind of all over the place. From a revenue management side, the airlines are probably more focused on their network planning as opposed to the revenue side, just because the demand has dropped so greatly. But you know, looking at the announcements from United or American and the overall reductions they're talking about on a national level, and even how that translates here, we don't have a clear picture of that yet because they haven't given us updated schedules for the market yet.
So this is a whole new iteration in the life of Kevin Boone as
Well, it's ironic director. Because you go back to the beginning of this year with the start of the San Diego service in January. We started Las Vegas back in October, and 2020 was tracking to be our, as you would expect, our biggest year ever, busiest year ever, and February was a record month, and here we are in March and just watching it go completely the other way. So how quickly it can change.
And then there's some collateral damage. Your publicist sent out a press release yesterday about...
Yeah, so Country Airlines announced this week that they will be suspending Las Vegas service here at the end of the month.
That's their primary... Target, right?
Yeah, on the West Coast, they
for outbound fly out of San Luis Obispo. That's
exactly, yeah. And they're ceasing operations, suspending in Santa Barbara as well. Mm-hmm. So the first of what I'm sure won't be the last of markets that are going to suspend. You know, Las Vegas has been particularly hard hit as a major leisure destination, and so many of the casinos closing. That
have you heard any scuttlebutt from the airport director there about their world at McCarran?
Just what I've seen in the media with the mm-hmm. problems they had with air traffic control there and how that affected the operation, but nothing directly.
Yeah. Las Vegas, of all towns in America, is probably the most dependent on air travel for their lifeline.
Certainly, yeah relatively isolated and high tourism demand. You know, like all things, this ultimately will return to some level of normal. Mm-hmm. What that new normal will look like, we don't know. We're trying to make a lot of decisions here in a very short period of time, I would say, with an understanding of what the, you know, what the immediate impact is, but then also trying to not forget that we don't want to abandon a thought of the future and the kind of decisions we're making right now, and you know, how we maintain the relationships with our rental car companies, our airlines, things that we've worked very hard here over the last many years to build, and not that things will be the same in the near term, but in a longer term view of all this, we want to make decisions now that really set us up for success.
so fascinating. I remember a couple of years ago I interviewed you, and you were the fifth fastest growing airport in North America.
In our category, absolutely. Yeah. And we continue to grow beyond that. And so we're proud to say we hit an all new level here, which I would say, despite what is happening, we've really proven the market to the airlines in ways that, you know, were once perhaps supposed or forecasted, but we've actually shown that is possible, certainly in a different economic climate than what we have now. But I'm confident that, like all things, we get through this. We make good decisions now that set us up for a strong recovery when the time is right, and it'll be back. We'll be updating folks as other changes occur.
How does somebody one-stop shopping to find out about updates?
On our website, we do have
slowairport.com.
We have a COVID-19 page, which has specifics of this current event. We'll be updating that. And then as we see significant changes from the carriers, we'll be issuing press releases. You know, I think what people can expect is, first and foremost, our markets that have multiple flights per day are probably going to see a reduction in frequency. And our goal is, you know, let's keep a market open. If we had three flights a day to Denver, let's try and keep it at one or more. And keeping a market open is really important to us. There's a lot of work that goes into launching a new market with an airline, and suspending a market, if we can avoid it, we'd really like to try and keep those open. So,
going forward under that scenario, let's say that I want to go outbound to Denver. Today, I might be on an aircraft with 20% capacity. Once they reduce, then you're going to be back up and have a fairly full flight.
We would hope. I think the idea in that is that they can fly with a higher load factor if they reduce the flights. Ultimately, the other thing I know the airlines are looking at is, well, if they take a particular market and put it in suspense, can people still get to where their ultimate destination is on that airline? And they would reaccommodate those travelers through a different hub.
So maybe go to Phoenix and then wherever.
I mean, so if your flight for Denver was ultimately canceled, could they reaccommodate you over another hub to get there? Perhaps. That there's a lot to that, but I think we went into this very strong as a market. You know, our market was performing extremely well, and we will emerge from this strong again. It's gonna take us all a while to get there.
Once again, if somebody wants to learn more about details of your travel,
go to our website, slowairport.com, and we're also updating on Facebook as well. So,
in your Facebook page is called what?
San Luis Obispo County Regional Airport. You can find it on Facebook. But we're watching all this very closely. We're working very hard to make sure the airport is as clean as we can possibly make it, and that we're able to keep the doors open and continue operating through really what is a kind of unimaginable event.
So sanitizing all surfaces, once again, primary.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Kevin Boomen, thank you for sharing.
Thanks, Tom. Great.
You're welcome. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from San Luis Obispo County Regional Airport.
In these days of uncertainty, it is hard to know where to find facts, not fiction. Information is everywhere on the internet, but it's not always factual. Issues and Ideas correspondent Brian Reynolds has a conversation with Kim Bishop, who teaches journalism at Cal Poly, about how to find news sources you can trust.
This is a very exciting opportunity for me, because today we're going to be talking about news, both fake and real, and how to get beyond that, how to identify those kinds of things, which we all see as a growing problem. Before we get into that, though, Kim, could you talk a little bit about yourself and sort of how you got to be a journalism lecturer at Cal Poly?
Sure. So I've worked in journalism since the mid-90s, and started out in newspapers and transitioned to magazines, and wrote a couple books. I've kind of worked all over the industry. I was a full-time freelancer when I first moved to San Luis Obispo, and there isn't much of a full-time freelancer community here like there is in bigger cities. And so I found myself just craving more opportunities for human interaction. And I applied to be in the part-time pool at Cal Poly, and I started teaching very occasionally there. And over the years, I just sort of flipped the ratios, and I love teaching. And now I do mostly teaching and still a little bit of writing on the side.
The way we gather information as human beings has changed so much, from analog to digital, from physical media to electronic media. Do you think there's still a role for traditional forms of media? And I'm thinking particularly of physical items like books, newspapers, magazines?
There certainly is. And I actually think in this digital era, it's more important than ever for people to consume some sort of print publications. There are a lot of reasons for this. One is that when you're reading a physical piece of journalism, it's less easy to have a spontaneous emotional reaction to that piece of journalism. And by that, I mean, if you want to share it, if you want to get excited about it and spread it around, you have to take the extra step of figuring out how to do that. Another reason is our kids are growing up without the brand awareness that we had when we grew up with our parents consuming media in ways that we could see visibly. It's important for us to share that experience with their kids so they understand what we consider to be a quality source of journalism, so that they can develop those habits themselves.
Do you think that reading a book or a magazine, or maybe even an official website, a reliable website, you know that the information has been vetted? It's been vetted to the level where they are not just a self-proclaimed expert, but some kind of verified expert, a peer-reviewed expert. And on the internet, we don't see that.
Sure. You know, one of the things I don't think is understood widely is that this fact-checking process has been a staple of at least the magazine journalism industry for decades. My first job in the magazine world was fact-checking for Outside Magazine. And this is not a new concept. This is something that has existed for a very long time. Still to this day, when I turn in a magazine article, I have to turn in a supplemental page that shows exactly who I talked to and where I got every piece of information. And there's a staff of fact checkers who will then go call my sources and verify, go to my documents and verify. The first thing we would do is, print out a copy of that story in its, edited form, and we would take a highlighter and highlight every single item in that story that could be verified, and then we'd go back to the author and we'd ask for their primary sources for every single verifiable piece of information, and then we would call those sources or go to those documents and go all the way through the story verifying.
Based on your background and your knowledge, professional knowledge, do you think those fact-checking activities still take place in the print world? Because they sure don't seem to be happening in the online world.
They are much less common in the online world. And it's become, magazines have the space for that in their editorial calendar. They turn around on a monthly basis, not a daily basis, or even, within the 24-hour news cycle, a minutely basis. It makes it much harder to fact-check in that environment. It still occurs. And the responsibility often falls on the reporter themselves for economic reasons and just, news turnaround reasons. But it's much less common online than it is in print, and in particular in monthly print.
I know this is simplistic, but is it because of the sense, real or perceived, of the essential need for speed?
Yeah, there's still, it's interesting. As consumers, we never really remember who got the story first, but we always remember who got it wrong. And I think that news outlets are becoming more aware of that. Certainly the more reputable ones would rather get it right than be first. But there's still, a widespread belief that you have to get the story first. You have to push the hot news out immediately. And unfortunately, accuracy suffers when you have that mindset.
A phrase I heard recently, I didn't invent this, but I love it. Speed is the knife of life. And what I added to it was, make sure which end of the knife you're holding.
Sure.
Because if you have it on the handle, you can use the knife as it's meant. But if you grab the blade in a hurry or a rush, you're going to have a different outcome.
Right. And in terms of reader trust, it's a lasting outcome. It's a really damaging outcome.
Right. And I know there's another psychological truism. We tend to remember slugs more than hugs. We go to a restaurant and get one bad meal. Might have been a fluky thing, but we'll never go back.
Right.
And that's maybe part of the cynicism. Well, let's imagine you're in your classroom and the first class of the semester. What would you tell them by way of an alarm bell, and what would you tell them the ways to fix things?
Well, in every class, I talk about the importance of building trust with our readers. It's not something I focused on, so much 15 years ago. It wasn't. It was just sort of assumed, and now I know that I can't make that assumption. I talk a lot about the importance of building trust with our readers, and the best way we do that is by being accurate. The other way we do that is through transparency. There was always this idea that journalism is something that happens behind closed doors. We just create the content and then we push it out and then readers consume the content. And that can't be the case anymore. We need to let our readers in on the process. That's why you see so many journalists who are very active on Twitter. That's part of the reason. It's important to let the reading public know that we're human. And the steps we took to get to the content that they eventually see.
How would such an approach interface with journalistic confidentiality, especially when revealing a source might be harmful to that person?
You know, confidential sources have always been an important part of certain types of reporting. If we have some information in confidence, then we would certainly never violate that. But I think, you know, in terms of being open about our process, we can certainly say, you know, I'm writing on this topic right now. Got an interview today. Here are the documents I've found. I want to share them with you. And what do you see? Here's what I'm seeing. And then by bringing our readers in on that process, number one, we help establish a relationship with them. And number two, sometimes they find things that we don't.
Right.
They know sources that we don't have. David Fahrenthold and the Washington Post is kind of the master of this type of reporting. If you follow his Twitter feed, you'll see he's constantly engaging with his readers. Here's what I'm reporting. Here's what I've found. What do you see?
I'm just wondering, is for a certain monthly cost, can a person subscribe to sources which are more authoritative?
Certainly. When we talk about business models in news, we understand that there is no one business model. You kind of have to hit it from all angles in order to make things work these days. The major shift, of course, was that ads went online, and Facebook and Google dominate that market. You know, ads online are pennies to the dollar compared to ads in print.
Cost-wise,
yeah. So, and revenue-wise, and for news publications. So advertising is definitely not as prominent an element of news organization business models as it once was. And then you're also hit by the fact that, you know, with the internet, there was this idea that information should all be free. And that was very harmful to the news industry. We had this wonderful democratization of information. You know, you no longer had to be behind a gatekeeper-run news organization in order to publish information. But then there was resistance among consumers to this idea that, you know, good journalism costs money. Good journalism still does cost money. Mm-hmm. I think readers are starting to understand the impact of this widespread notion that information should be free. I'm seeing more and more paywalls. I personally am subscribing to more publications than I did 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I used to think of it for a little while. I thought of it as a lot of money, and then I realized, wait a minute, you know, I could buy one less latte every week, and that's going to take care of this.
Are these online magazines or fact-checking organizations or all of the above?
I do donate to fact-checking organizations. I think they're doing fantastic work, and you know, nonpartisan and often you know, reader-supported and grant-supported. But, you know, the news organizations I subscribe to are like the San Luis Obispo Tribune and the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, Atlantic Magazine, you know, publications whose journalism I value. There are a lot of sources out there that are aggregating content, you know, taking other people's content and delivering it to us for free. But it's still important to, you know, somebody has to pay the people who are actually out there doing the good work.
Just to clarify, because this is kind of startling to me, I know for a fact that in a physical newspaper, the ad revenues were huge, much more important in the revenue stream than subscriptions, let's say. But that's not the paradigm online?
Not so much. I mean, you know, news organizations that are nationally known, like, you know, news brands like the New York Times, they're actually doing relatively well in terms of digital revenue. But smaller organizations have a really hard time making those numbers
work.
So if
it's not ads that's helping them, where do they get the revenues?
They're doing all kinds of things. One emerging model actually is events. You'll see more and more, you know, especially online independent news organizations sponsoring events, and they have memberships. They create value above the content, you know, the baseline content for readers that readers are willing to pay for.
You're listening to KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, and correspondent Brian Reynolds speaking with Kim Bishop, who teaches journalism at San Luis Obispo's Cal Poly. Let's get back to the conversation.
I admire the intellectual and the literati and glitterati of the early 1900s, Oscar Wilde and James Joyce, all these people. And there would be literary salons. A countess would invite people like that to get people to attend. And so for the price of a drink or maybe knowing somebody, you could literally stand and eavesdrop on Oscar Wilde having a conversation with Bernard Shaw. I mean, it's
yes.
Maybe that could happen online, too. I mean, I don't see why not.
Absolutely. There's a news organization in Santa Barbara called NewsHawk, and they've been very successful at this. Mm. You know, they have this wonderful, devoted reader base that you know, has memberships. You will pay for memberships. And part of the benefit of being a member is that they have opportunities to interact with, you know, Santa Barbara's version of Oscar Wilde.
Sure, sure. I'd like to remind everyone, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we're joined by Kim Bishop, journalism lecturer at Cal Poly, and we're talking about news, both fake and factual. What would you say is the most important aspect to our topic today, the issue of fake news? Is it the people? Is it the institutions? And what's at stake?
Well, I think, you know, the most important point to me is that we can't expect the institutions to save us. We can't expect the government to save us. It really comes down to personal responsibility. We have to be smarter about consuming information.
I know that in terms of consumer protection, our government has been active for a long time. Not, if you go back to the Pure Food and Drug Act, I'll say the year 1906, passing a law making sure or trying to make sure that what was in a jar or a can was what was on the label. And it could be contaminated, it could be adulterated, it could be fake. And so our government has a 114-year-old history of protecting consumers for things they put in their bodies, medicines and food and drink. But if you think about how we govern ourselves, how we might be responding to a looming pandemic like the coronavirus, where we need accurate, unbiased information in simple to understand terms, the governments seem to be backing off. Or now you might be saying they don't have a role or whatever role they could do. And so it's up to each one of us. That's kind of scary.
It is kind of scary. I mean, we live in a society where capitalism is the rule. And because of that, there will always be a lot of pressure to do the thing that makes sense for businesses. You know, it's wonderful that our government won't allow advertisers to sell snake oil. But, you know, the fake ads that we see on Facebook are kind of the information equivalent of snake oil. And yet they're protected by the people who own those businesses with the argument of free speech. So it's an interesting time. I think eventually there will be more regulation. But in the meantime, there are some actual pretty easy steps that we can all take to help solve the problem by ourselves. First and foremost, misinformation is designed to cause a strong emotional reaction. When people react to something, they're more likely to share it, and that translates to dollars and views for the people who created that misinformation. So the very first thing we can do is, if we read something that makes us feel a really strong emotion, especially fear or anger, or validation, like, yeah, that exactly is what I've been talking about and validates my existing beliefs, we just need to stop. If we could just stop right there and pause, and if we're not sure about it, just stop interacting with it. Don't share it, don't like it, don't angry face it, don't sad face it, don't retweet it, don't talk about it. Just stop and create sort of a misinformation quarantine zone. If we all did that more often, this would stop tomorrow.
So if one by one we got organized, we, the people, and just followed your prescription, if it was visceral, good or bad, we just say, well, at minimum, I'm going to wait 12 hours
right
before I share it.
Right.
And maybe corroborate it before I do.
Yeah, so wait for that immediate emotional reaction to pass or settle down a little bit. And then if you decide to take steps to check it out, then there are multiple layers of checking it out that we could engage in as consumers.
Is a company like, is it PolitiFact? Are the groups like that helpful in real time?
Hugely helpful. I just saw something come from some relatives. There was an email that came at me, and I just asked everyone to stop, wait 24 hours for the fact checkers to be able to do their work, and then wait and see what comes up on the internet. And sure enough, within 24 hours, there were excellent fact checks that cited their sources. And, you know, it's important for us to fact check the fact checkers.
Right.
But good fact checkers have transparency. They share their sources and their methods. And PolitiFact is one of them, factcheck.org, Snopes.
You know, I've been doing a lot of reading about how we make decisions in the psychological world, and it turns out that we give way too much emphasis to our own expertise and way too little to things that you can't predict, good luck, bad luck. One of the outcomes of that kind of research is that if you have to make an important decision before you share it with the world physically or electronically, you try to corroborate it, and one of the ways to corroborate it is a simple algorithm. Your New York Times reporter, one of his algorithms is reader response.
Mm-hmm.
But do you do lectures or workshops or community activity like that?
I do. You know, I'm a little bit of a tech nerd. I was an early adopter of social media. I was really excited about the technology, and I think like a lot of that world, I was very quickly worried and disenfranchised about the consequences of that technology on our democracy. So I have for the past several years been lecturing about it and giving community talks and writing articles about it and profiling fact checkers and trying to help consumers become aware of their own role in solving this problem.
Is there a yearning for that, a hunger for that that you've seen?
It's amazing to me how much of a response I get when I write about this or talk about it. It's unlike anything I've ever done before.
Hmm.
There's a lot of uncertainty among readers right now. They, you know, unfortunately, what I'm seeing a lot of is complete disengagement. You know, they get so overwhelmed and don't know who to trust, and then at some point they just give up and walk away.
Right.
And that, to me, is the biggest danger. Yeah.
Well, as we get towards the end of the interview, Kim, what would be one or two takeaways you'd like to leave with us?
I would encourage people to engage with news and really think about sources they trust. Facebook is wonderful for seeing pictures of our friends' kids. It's a terrible place to get information about the world. Go to primary news sources. If you think the New York Times is a great news organization, pay for it. If you think that you know, the Wall Street Journal is the best place to get your news, subscribe. Go directly to those sources for information instead of relying on social media and hearsay.
I think it's quite significant that we're talking today in a community radio station, a public radio station. We're not talking on NPR or a commercial station. That would seem to be a little odd. I mean, like, why would they want to hear it from us?
Right.
But thank goodness we have these outlets like KCBX and others that help us stay on track. What would be, let's say, can you recommend a website or something that you go to frequently, one thing that stands out to help with this fact-checking while people are taking that very important pause?
Snopes is always my go-to. There are a lot of conspiracy theorists who like to attack Snopes. And, you know, so I ask people, don't take my word for it. Go check out Snopes. Go to the International Fact-Checking Network and see the criteria they use to verify that Snopes is an excellent organization. But that's my go-to for things that give me pause.
Easily done. I would like also, as we wind up, to give a shout-out to public libraries and libraries of all types. This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Kim Bishop, journalism lecturer at Cal Poly.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll see how the creation of a bioswale at Atascadero Lake will help keep the water clean for all who enjoy it, including residents and wildlife.
It's supposed to work kind of like a wetland, and ideally we can just use a little bit of elbow grease and get things in order to work the way nature would want it to work.
Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. Just before Central Coast residents were asked to shelter at home, a group of volunteers gathered at Atascadero Lake to create a bioswale. As the work was underway, I stopped in to talk with a couple of the organizers. First, Andrew Johnson, program manager with the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Resource Conservation District. Then I spoke with Haley Barnes, a member of the Watershed Stewards Program. Here's Johnson.
This project is really indicative of what resource conservation districts are here for. We have folks here from the Atascadero Land Preservation Society, and they have a lot of trail work experience. We can hear them pounding away at some of the rock right now, and they understand how to key together natural trail features as well as maintaining the aesthetic. The position of a resource conservation district allows us to reach out to all these different folks and bring them in to a site like this to help beautify the area.
Where did you get all these volunteers, and I'm seeing dirt, but over there I see that there are rocks in a ditch.
Right. Well, first off, we're seeing soil. this is a healthy area that we are just adding a little new feature to improve the quality of water in Atascadero Lake. We have so many volunteers today. We're always happy to see people show up for an event like this. Tons of volunteers from fraternities and sororities at Cal Poly. I believe there's a couple of other groups that were able to get the word out. The Watershed Stewardship Program members that are working with us did a spectacular job of using every available resource to make sure that people heard about this, and we've really had a great showing. I think we've got nearly 80 volunteers throughout the day so far. What we're seeing is the creation of a bioswale. The idea is at one of these inlets uphill from the lake, where water traditionally is flowing down into the lake, we're creating this feature that will allow the water to slow down, drop out some of the less desirable qualities that come off of roads, that come out of people's backyards. There's a lot of animal effluent that you can always assume is flowing downhill into creeks and streams, which eventually end up in these lakes. We want to keep those things out of the lake. It's for water quality overall. So this bioswale feature will allow the water to slow down and drop some of the sediment that would be floating in the water out. It settles down into this settling area, and then the water can then be cleaned in the natural processes of soil cleansing and flow into the lake a lot cleaner than it would have otherwise been.
Well, it seems like a really rather low-tech but perfect answer to a problem.
You know, it's supposed to work kind of like a wetland, and ideally we can just use a little bit of elbow grease and get things in order to work the way nature would want it to work. Traditionally, a space like this without our influence would be low-lying. It would allow the water to slow down before it enters the creek and naturally filter out some of the less desirable qualities from our inputs.
Right. So is there anything else like this in our county that you know of?
Yeah, actually, bioswales are becoming in vogue. We're seeing a lot of them put in the lower end of parking lots. I'm not sure if it's quite one of the regulatory requirements yet, but we are seeing it. I noticed that there's a bioswale next to a new bank going in of Higuera in San Luis Obispo. It's a small little space, but it doesn't really require all that much. And it's also kind of a way to green up a space that's otherwise just a parking lot. So why not add a little bit of greenery, a little bit of... And there's a supporter right there. So people are fans of these sort of projects, and we've had support driving by on the road all day long, people stopping and taking pictures, people asking what we're up to out here, and everybody loves the idea of something natural and watching people hard at work to reproduce what nature was already really good at, and something that we're seeing more and more often. City planners and developers are including as part of the plan for a new park or a parking lot or a housing development. It's a green space. It attracts pollinators as well. There's going to be plants growing up. Right now it's all dirt and rocks, but pretty soon it's going to be green and lush because this is where the water wants to flow.
And it looks like you brought in some mulch too. Where does that mulch come from?
I believe the mulch is coming from the city of Atascadero. Madrone Landscaping was a really big help with this project. They provided a lot of labor and expertise. They're providing all of the irrigation for the plants that we're going to be putting in.
It looks like you say, maybe fraternity sorority. There's a little kid over there somewhere, too.
Yeah, there's little kids helping out, and we always have work for them. We have some small tools, child-sized tools, and we're all about being safe and making sure everybody has fun. So there's proper protective equipment for folks who are using picks, because there is some heavy labor to be done. A lot of these rocks are pretty sizable, and you know we're keying in some features that will produce pooling structure, and you have to be able to move some heavy equipment. We had the city helping out with their backhoe earlier, moving some of the larger pieces and delivering some of the soils and mulch and rock on site to make it easier for the volunteers to be really effective today. So that way we weren't just saying, everybody start hauling rock.
That wouldn't be a great way to get future volunteers.
Yeah, we're trying to enthuse people, and we want to make sure that when we're reaching out for help in the future, people understand that they get to actually affect change. And this is a really great project for that, because it becomes painfully obvious after 30 minutes of using a shovel in these really dense clayey soils that labor is what's needed to make work get done. So a lot of sweat equity going into this project from a lot of different groups coming out here. It's the sort of space that gets a lot of public attention because we're on the Atascadero Lake Park walk, and again, like I said, folks walking by and appreciating it, but a lot of those folks have stopped their walk, leashed their animals, and they've come out and grabbed a shovel and helped us out too. So people see that they can affect change, and they can walk by this in the future and say, hey, you know, that was part of something I did. And we hope to recruit more volunteers for future projects like this in public space, because they want to.
Yeah, and these guys, they're working hard, but I see a lot of smiles.
Yeah, nobody's sad to be out here right now. Luckily, the rain's held off, and it's not sunny today, so no sunburn issues to be concerned about. And I think everybody, by the time they're done here today, is going to realize that they earned whatever Friday night holds.
Okay, thank you so much.
But it's looking really good. They've dug all of these trenches by hand, and now we are putting in these check dams, and we're using small boulders and rocks and making sure that that's really secure so that when water flows down, it's held in this basin area so that it can infiltrate into the ground.
I asked Barnes about the Watershed Stewards Program.
WSP is considered one of the most productive programs for future employment in natural resources, and it's a great foot in the door for people who are looking to get into natural resources. Most of the people who are in the program are fresh out of college, but some people are looking for more experience there, and it's a great way to work with an organization or an agency and learn what it's like to work for something like that, and it's been a really great experience for me in that way.
So why a bioswale, specifically for Atascadero Lake?
So Atascadero gets very hot in the summer, and also Atascadero Lake is very shallow. So as nutrients come in from the surrounding areas, it provides an amazing habitat for algae. And so it blooms. For the city of Atascadero, it's a nuisance because it smells bad, and it's such an important part of the community and such a great open space for recreation, for fishing, for bird watching. It's great habitat for birds, as well as some species of concern, including the western pond turtle and the red-legged frog. And then downstream of the lake is Atascadero Creek. And so when the lake fills up in the wintertime, it overflows and goes into Atascadero Creek, and that is steelhead habitat. And so that's happening in the winter months, and steelhead are sensitive to water quality. Hopefully this will help reduce the amount of algae blooms and also improve the water quality for the fish and wildlife habitat there.
That was Haley Barnes of the Watershed Stewards Program.
They're a great way to manage stormwater.
Could somebody just go online and say, I think that would be a good idea for my yard?
Absolutely, yeah. Last year, WSP members in San Luis Obispo installed a bioswale next to a parking lot and alleviated all of the flooding. It can filter all of the oil and fertilizers and things like that that are running off during storm events. And so it captures that and it filters it, preventing it from going into our waterways.
What I noticed, it seemed like it was just digging ditches and putting rocks in there.
Yeah, you can do it with rock. You can also do it with mulch. It depends on your aesthetic, what you're trying to do. Wood chips are usually what people use, that they dig a pretty deep hole and then you fill it significantly with wood chips, and then you add species like rushes and sedges and grasses that are pretty hardy but can also be submerged. And yeah, it just really helps to absorb all of that water and bring it back into the soil and then hopefully bring it back into our groundwater.
That was Haley Barnes of the Watershed Stewards Program. Before that, we heard from Andrew Johnson, Program Manager with the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Resource Conservation District. To learn more about the Watershed Stewards Program and its projects, Google ccc.wsp. That will take you to their page on the California Conservation Corps' website. And finally, there are other new additions at Atascadero Lake. After about 12 years, rainbow trout are being reintroduced to the lake. The trout will be catch and eat, not just catch and release. The group Friends of Atascadero Lake has been working with the City of Atascadero and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to stock sterile trout in Atascadero Lake. Fish and Wildlife wants to create more fishing opportunities in San Luis Obispo County, says Atascadero's Deputy City Manager Terry Banish, and it was the right time to bring back the fish.
At one point, we had goats in the lake because it was completely dry, so that was kind of a management tool that we went, had the goats there and doing their part, and then it ended up getting filled back up again. But it is a viable area. It's the Atascadero Lake Park. It's the Charles Paddock Zoo. It's kind of our event center where Pavilion on the Lake is. So it's got all kinds of pieces to it that the lake is a big part of that. And a lot of people, you know, over probably 300 people a day walk around that lake. They take their dogs on walks. So it's a big part of our community and area.
Atascadero Public Works Director Nick DeBar says the effort to stock Atascadero Lake with sport fish is a project collaboration a few years in the making.
5 years ago, when the lake went dry in the drought, the city actually excavated out the bottom of the lake and took out a lot of material to back to the original contours. And then when the rain started coming and the lake started filling back up about 4 years ago, we talked to Fish and Wildlife about stocking the lake, and the lake is, when it does fill up, it spills into a channel that goes into Atascadero Creek. That section of Atascadero Creek is protected habitat for steelhead. So when we first talked to the Fish and Wildlife, they said they couldn't stock it because if any of the fish got out, it would be a take on the steelhead habitat. So we talked to them about putting a fish screen in that channel, and Fish and Wildlife just a couple weeks ago put a fish screen in, and what that does is it prevents any fish from getting out of the channel that drains from the lake into the creek. So there's takes away that threat, and now they can stock the lake. So we've been working with Friends of the Lake as well. Recreation is the primary purpose, and Fish and Wildlife has had some changes. They've been really, I think the new commissioners that they have in Sacramento have been more, and I think this is in a reaction to perhaps maybe hunting and fishing license census being down, that they want to provide more fishing opportunities, especially in metro areas. I think Atascadero Lake is ideal lake to introduce fish again, really for recreation, to provide, you know, kids a convenient way to go catch fish, or adults alike, and without having to travel up to the Sierras or whatever. It's not necessarily for the health of the lake. It's more for recreation. Fish are actually coming from a hatchery outside Fresno. And so they've been in a controlled environment. The fish are going to be somewhere between, I've been told they're going to be between like 2/3 of a pound to a pound. And so that equates to approximately 600 to 750 fish released into the lake. And they're hatchery fish. They're safe to eat. If people want to catch them and release them, that's fine too. But people, they'll be safe to eat.
That was Nick DeBar, Public Works Director for the City of Atascadero. Kids 16 and younger don't need a fishing license to catch the rainbow trout, and the limit is 5 fish per person. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. That's kcbx.org.